I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Weekend edition of Parallax Views coming at ya as debuting sci-fi novelist Brian M. Lewis joins us to discuss his novel, the first in the Homo Maximus saga, Pharima, an Afro-futurist sci-fi adventure. In these trying times of pandemic and government suppression, sometimes you just need a bit of positive escapism, and that's exactly what Brian does in Pharima. I'll let him explain the book to you in the conversation that follows. But let's just say that it provides a rather utopian vision of the future that stands in stark contrast to dystopian trends in literature. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Brian M. Lewis, author of Pharima, an Afrofuturist sci-fi adventure. Welcome to Parallax Views, Brian Lewis, author of Pharima, an Afrofuturist sci-fi adventure, book one of the Homo Maximus saga. This is going to be an interesting discussion. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm great. I'm just enjoying the view, and it's a nice sunny day out in North Carolina where I'm currently located. So thank you for having me.
So, Brian, maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar, what is your sort of background? What got you into writing?
Well, I've been writing really since I was in high school. But, I mean, it was really just personal stuff. And, you know, I used to participate in different, you know, online message boards and groups like that. And I used to post a lot of stuff that I used to just write in my spare time online just to, you know, join other people and interact with other people. And we used to do this whole shared story thing. I don't think that's too popular anymore. I don't see people doing that too much anymore, but it used to be popular, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But I mean, it was always in my agenda to write a book. It was probably always going to be a science fiction book as well, science fiction or fantasy, because that's kind of, those are the genres I gravitate to, for, you know, purely escapist reasons. And so, in terms of my background, like, I actually have, a lot of people don't know this, I actually do have a theater degree, and because I do like performing from time to time. I haven't done it in years, but that was a passion of mine some years back. So, writing, performing, anything that allows me to use my creative, you know, my creative mind to, build worlds and things like that. That's always been appealing to me. So Pharima was really going to happen sooner or later. Yeah, ideally it should have happened a little bit sooner, but, I turned 33 this year, but, you know, it's better late than never though.
So you mentioned that you like the sort of sci-fi genre. What got you interested in sci-fi, the sort of escapism of it? What was your introduction to the genre?
Honestly, my intro to the genre was Star Wars. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I think some of the first science fiction books I read were Star Wars books. I want to say it might have been the Thrawn trilogy. I don't know how many people are familiar with that, But it's one of the more popular trilogies and then in that whole, you know, universe. And then of course, not just, you know, books, but movies as well. I think with science fiction and fantasy, I think there's a benefit that it gives you in terms of being able to sometimes escape from the grind of current events and everything that's going on in the world around you. I definitely use that to my advantage when writing Farmer. Like there were days when I would write purely as a way to take my mind off of, you know, just crazy stuff that you see going on in the world and on social media and things like that. It really allowed me to escape into this fictional world that I created. And then honestly, now I might be getting a little ahead of myself, but it eventually did become a way for me to also envision what type of society could be built in the future. You know, all things considered, if everything kind of fell into place and worked its way out, you know, things don't necessarily have to be dystopian. You know, the future doesn't have to necessarily be this bleak, dark, you know, unforgiving world that, you know, in the future things, you know, could be better potentially. So that was something that I definitely used to build my world that I created.
Now, for my listeners that haven't checked out Farima, I think I was saying Farima earlier. What's the pronunciation there?
Farima. Farima is fine.
Okay. Okay. I was making sure. So for my listeners that haven't had a chance to pick up the book, I know it's on Kindle Unlimited right now. What is the sort of basic story of it? It centers around Dr. Natalia Greenheart, but what's the sort of basic story? It takes place in 2082, I believe.
Right. It takes place in 2082 in a fictional nation known as New Mandan. So, yes, you're right. It centers around a couple of different characters. It centers around Natia, Dr. Natia Greenheart, who is a geneticist, and then her mentor, a man named Khalil. And the story basically revolves around a project that she's been working on that could potentially lead to, you know, human beings living an extended period of time by creating these. I don't want to say clones because they're not really clones, but creating these almost like these beings or these human beings that are a little bit more advanced. And the kicker is because of the way that the society is structured, it's not a capitalistic society. So it's not based around, you know, people having access to this technology based on the amount of money you have. It's almost treated like universal healthcare in a way. So you would have it, you would be able to have access to it purely by just being a member of the nation. And of course there are people who don't want that. There are people who are going to stand against her, people who are actually a little bit close to her, you know. So the story revolves around her trying to finish this project, this where she has these very altruistic goals in mind. But she's, you know, maybe a little misguided in the beginning, and she has to, throughout the course of the book, sort of figure out, you know, in a way, kind of unlearn things that she learned in the past and finish the project potentially. I don't want to give too much of the way about the book, but in the meantime, you know, protecting her country and save her country from this threat that, you know, that everybody kind of thought was no longer an issue anymore. I'm trying to talk around it a little bit without giving too much away.
But yeah, it reminds me a little bit of, not to interrupt you, but it reminds me a little bit of Altered Carbon, but maybe with a little bit of a more left-wing vibe.
It does. And what's funny is I started writing this I would say late 2016, because really when I started writing this, I didn't sit down and have it all fleshed out. Originally, this was going to be about a 50 or 60 page novella. But as I kept writing it more and more and more over time, because I would stop and start, and you know, I was working at the time as well, so I couldn't really commit that much time to it. It grew, like, so it went from like a 50 or 60 page novella to being this 100 page novella, and then now, like, the paperback itself, the paperback version, is about 235 pages. So it's grown a lot. It's the story has evolved, and I think the intention that I originally had has kind of shifted and changed. And then also on top of that, people might get Black Panther vibes from it, the movie, you know, the Marvel movie Black Panther. But this, I actually started writing this, you know, at least maybe about a year and a half before that even came out. So there's a little bit of overlap, but I wasn't really too influenced by that much.
You know, it's interesting too, you mention New Mandan, which is basically where the story is set. What were your influences for that environment? You know, it's a very utopian vision as opposed to the sort of dystopian visions we get in a lot of literature today.
Right, that is correct. So New Mandan, if from a historical perspective, if people are interested, Mandan was the historical name of an actual African nation that existed in the Middle Ages. And it, like, that kind of plays into the whole sort of Afrofuturistic vibes of the story. A lot of people don't really know that, so I don't expect people to know that offhand. But yeah, like, it's, I didn't want to write a dystopian story because I feel like there's just a lot of that already. And then you just look at current events, we're in many ways kind of living in a dystopia. So I wanted to go in a different direction. You know, I didn't want to create something where I said the future is going to be perfect, because the future isn't perfect, but it can at least be better than it actually is right now. And of course, you know, I'm a left-wing person myself. You know, that's sort of like my political view. So of course, you know, I kind of fit that into the story as well, because yeah, I wanted to see, you know, what would a potential, you know, left-wing government, like a truly progressive left-wing government, how would that actually function? Like, what would happen if you actually had a society where the resources were, you know, shared a little bit better, or the governance structure was a little bit more direct? So you can say, like, New Mandan is a type of direct democracy where people have direct influence in decisions that get made. Like, there's a part in the book in the very beginning where Nazi is at this event called the Great Forum. And the Great Forum is basically, you know, think of it as a group of people coming around, everyone that has a vested interest in the society. So all of the workers in the society, and, you know, regular people, like leaders in the society and just regular people as well, can go to the Great Forum and pitch policy proposals and ideas for how to, you know, enact different, you know, laws and things within the country. And then everybody gets to vote on it. You know, I don't know if a society like that would actually be able to function because of people and self-interest and things like that. But it's an excellent, I think, way to fictionalize the future that I really wanted to explore.
I was going to say that's a really interesting area to explore for me, because I think in literature, there is this sort of trend of, you know, the sci-fi stuff has to be dystopian. We can't really have utopian ideas. And I think it's related to this idea that sort of a pessimistic vision of the world or a cynical vision is seemingly more like authentic. And I think this happened in hip hop culture too, at certain points. I mean, back in the late 80s or early 90s, there were, you know, sort of the more positive hip hop bands. And then there were the bands dealing with, you know, darker stuff. And it seems like the sort of pessimistic, cynical sort of viewpoint has really taken hold in our culture.
It has. And honestly, I don't, I can't really say what the source of that is. I mean, I want to say it's money, but really, I think there's money in a positive view of the future. I don't really know what the source of that is, but I do agree. Like it seems really pervasive, you know, where, you know, I think honestly, people like me, like creators like myself, writers like myself, anybody that wants to, you know, write themselves and you see sort of problems in society today, you know, you can actually write something that's different from the norm. And if that becomes popular and enough people read that it does kind of influence people to say, hey, you know what? You know, maybe we can work this stuff out. Maybe we can, you know, it's a little idealistic, maybe even a lot idealistic, I would say. But I think that's kind of needed in society today, because I think people are being bombarded with negativity constantly, all the time, every day, especially if you're on social media. It's nothing. Well, it kind of depends on who you're following on social media too. But, you know, I follow a lot of political people. So it's constantly like, you know, bad story after bad story after bad story. And people need to, even if it's fictional, people need to, you know, think at least that, you know, something better can come out of this. Even though, like, you know, you support politicians like Bernie Sanders and they seem to just get railroaded. But, you know, we have to keep fighting the good fight, I believe. And even if it's something as simple as writing a fictional story like Farama, you know, hopefully people read it and get that impression from it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in a lot of ways, trying to just imagine a better vision or a different vision of the future that isn't entirely negative, I think in a way that's become an act of courage in our cultural zeitgeist, because, you know, the more paranoid side of me puts it this way. I feel like there's been a concerted effort to shut down the valves of our collective imagination. You know, there's this idea, the world is just the way it is. These people like Bernie Sanders are idealists, they're too optimistic, and, you know, this is just the way things are, and we can't really change it. And to me, it's brave to say, hey, why don't we try to imagine a place like Numandan?
Right. And then to people who say that, like, a lot of times I question people's agenda as well. Like, so is that, like, their particular belief? Like, do you actually believe that, or are you kind of just being self-serving? I don't really know, because I hear a lot of people say things like that, and I'm like, are you actually paying attention to what's going on? we cannot possibly think that things can maintain, you know, a certain status quo can be maintained, and we're going to actually have the type of society that we want, where people are actually able to live and thrive and grow and develop. You know, at some point in time, you have to have a society that's flexible, and that's, you know, it can't always be resistant to change. And right now, I think there are just a lot of people who are resistant to change for different reasons, and even like across the political spectrum. So it's not even like a right versus left thing. I just think that people get complacent and, you know, envisioning something better is needed, like, in this. And I agree with you. I think there is a courage that goes along with it, because it's not typical. Like, you don't, and I was even a friend of mine who I was getting to help spread the word for Farama, you know, she even said that, you know, you don't really see any other books like this. And I'm not trying to say the book is perfect or anything like that, because, you know, there are things, this is my first book, you know, and I intend to stretch this out, you know, into a series. So, you know, I've taken in, you know, things that I could probably improve in the next book that I didn't necessarily do in the first book. But she said there aren't too many examples of this. And I kind of sat back and I said, you know, you're right. Like, so, yeah, it's you know, I think people who have come across it and have read parts of it, you know, they've mostly given me positive feedback. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting journey for sure.
And is the paperback version out? I've only had a chance to look at the ebook version.
The paperback version I'm actually going to upload soon. The only reason I hesitate saying that is because the paperbacks that I ordered were for the Indiegogo campaign that I did. And so there were some people who bought into a package where I was offering a paperback. So I do have some left over. I think I might have like 15 paperbacks left over that after I sent out to everybody that paid for one. So I will be uploading that soon, but I really honestly need to just reorder some more. It's not up there yet. So people can still get the Kindle version, but the paperback version will be up there soon.
It's interesting too, because you mentioned Afrofuturism, and it's funny, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on actually was because I've had a few authors and scholars on recently who are involved with the sort of academic work around this idea of Afro-pessimism, like Dr. Frank Wilderson. And I wanted to show the other side of that because, I mean, Afro-pessimism is sort of it's an inversion of a lot of Afro-futurist tropes. But I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with Afrofuturism. So maybe you could give an outline sort of what Afrofuturism is and the influence it has had on your work.
Right. So Afrofuturism has been around for a few decades now. I think a lot of people go back to Octavia Butler and her books that she wrote. For instance, The Parable of the Sower. Which I have to actually read the rest of. I read part of it, but I kind of got distracted. But yeah, it's a genre that I would say it honestly doesn't even have to involve, you know, the future necessarily, or even something in science fiction. So it's an aesthetic that plays into a lot of positive images of, you know, Black characters, for instance, characters that a lot of times in the past kind of wouldn't have been included in certain stories or centered in certain stories. You see them centered in, and not even just the characters themselves, but a lot of times the world around the characters have, you know, Afro things to it. So, and like, that's something that I really played into my story as well. So even just in the name of the nation, New Mandan, that kind of, and even like, that's kind of why I brought up like the origin of the name itself, because even that kind of just plays into it. But it's honestly, I would say it's a very flexible subgenre that I think a lot of people first, you know, heard about with Black Panther in 2018. I would say that's a, you know, Ryan Coogler's movie, or the movie he directed, is a good example of, or a good introduction for a lot of people into the genre. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. So, you know, I mean, you could have an Afrofuturistic story that's, you know, a little bit more, you know, contemporary, or a little bit more grounded. It doesn't really necessarily have to be, you know, fantastical in nature. It can really be used to envision a future that's a little bit more, not even necessarily positive, but better than where we are currently, right? So I may mention earlier about how oftentimes the current environment and the current world is dystopian, especially for you know, a lot of Black people and other people of color, you know. And that kind of just plays into current events. So a lot of times writers have used their creative imagination to envision a different set of norms, where you have these Black characters who don't have to necessarily worry about the things that we have to worry about in society today. Maybe it takes place in the far future. Maybe it doesn't. Like New Mandan takes place in 2082. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's the far future, but it's definitely the future for sure. I would even honestly say that this subgenre is not as large as other subgenres. So there are still a lot of authors who can contribute and kind of expand the definition of Afrofuturism and potentially take it to places where, you know, it hasn't actually gone yet. And that's kind of what I saw myself doing with Pharma, as a matter of fact, because, you know, you look at the cover and you see this woman on the cover, and you see these island, these circular island, and they're really what I call them in the book. I call them Jennas, but it's really like this semi-aquatic nation where these man-made islands, and you know, exist where people, you know, can live on them, and they connect with bridges and things like that. So it's a completely different envisioning of us, you know, the structure of society and how people can organize themselves and self-organize. And it's done with a you know, Afrofuturistic aesthetic, but it's accessible to everybody. So it's not something that I wrote specifically for one group or another. So yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I want to get back to that accessibility, but first I wanted to say, it's funny. We were sort of talking about Afrofuturism in terms of being a literary genre, but you know, my introduction to Afrofuturism was very odd, because it wasn't through Octavia Butler or fiction novels, and it wasn't through the Black Panther. I was actually a big fan because I had a lot of like hippie friends who were extremely into Sun Ra and his orchestra, mm-hmm. which is, you know, for listeners that don't know, he's sort of like this spaced out Afrofuturist jazz music. And I just really dug it in my college years. And it's fascinating because to me, Afrofuturism, it can be found in music, film, literature. It's all over the place. It's a very powerful and profound aesthetic.
You're right. So yeah, I was speaking mostly about the literary, but yeah, you're right. It does expand into, you know, music, and I kind of wish that there was a little bit more of that. It probably is, and I just, you know, I'm just not exposed to it. But yeah, it can be a music form, it can be an art form, so not even just literary. There are different, you know, people can look it up online. There are different artists, digital artists, that have, done paintings and different forms of digital art based around, you know, Afrofuturism or Afrofuturistic aesthetics. I would say it's very flexible. And I'm glad to see that it's getting a little bit more attention, and I hope it continues, because I think it's very different from what you were talking about hip hop earlier. Like it's very different from certain cultural aesthetics that are put out there a lot more and are a lot more visible, but aren't always, you know, aren't always the most constructive, and can actually go into the destructive zone of things. So I think like Afrofuturism is a good, you know, polar balance to that potentially. I think that we are kind of just beginning to see this aesthetic, this genre, kind of blossom into its own thing. And I just hope to be, you know, a contributor to that in the long run.
I was going to add in that regard, something I find interesting is sort of how the dominant mainstream culture portrays Black culture as sort of monolithic. I think, you know, I'll talk to people and they'll say, oh, BET is representative of all of Black culture. And I'm like, I don't think that's true. There's Afrofuturist literature out there. And then people will say, what is that? And it sort of makes me sad that the dominant culture in our society, the white culture, they have a very limited view of the contributions that Black artists have made over time. It's not just, you know, gangster rap. And I like my gangster rap too, but there's all kinds of contributions out there and all kinds of different artwork from African-American people.
Right. And I mean, I think there's a financial incentive to that. I think the people who are putting their money into certain artists and certain aesthetics and certain, you know, just certain vibes, for the lack of a better term. I mean, I think they're using their money in a way that they think, you know, black culture is like. So it's very actually kind of manipulative in many ways, because it kind of implies that if you want to be successful, you have to be a certain way, you know, or if you want to be, if you want to be, you know, if you want to get that deal, so to speak, then you have to, you know, dance to the tune that the people can, you know, write your check, want you to dance to. And I know that's kind of, that might be something of a generalization, because you do have other avenues for artists to get out there now, especially nowadays with the internet. But there was a point in time when that, that wasn't there. They, you know, they didn't really have those other venues like that. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's unfortunate, because I think even like, if you look at my book, like there are a lot of things in Farmer that I could imagine, people having a problem with. And so like, because somebody told me one time that, you know, it would be kind of cool if they made that into a movie. And I said, hey, you know, that's true. But then too, like they'd have to, display a functioning left-wing government, which is probably something that they don't want to do. Then too, I also have blockchain technology, you know, in the book as well. They would have to, you know, display a functioning left-wing government, with a blockchain economy, where people can just create these, you know, these cryptocurrency tokens and things like that. And, you know, you don't necessarily need this centralized hierarchical government to actually do everything, on top of, you know, a story starring, you know, a black female, you know, lead character, and her, you know, black male mentor, and they live in this society that's kind of in not so many ways saying that, hey, you know, we've kind of progressed past, you know, needing you and needing, you know, the structure that you created and the system that you've created. In the future, we're actually going to build our own thing, and it's going to be successful. And we might just create these private islands and just go off into the Atlantic somewhere and just leave you to your own devices. You know, that, I can imagine somebody sitting in a boardroom saying, I don't know about that. So, I think there's definitely not only a financial incentive, but a cultural incentive to display black culture a certain way. And I mean, that's unfortunate, but I think we have ways to combat that. I think, you know, music, art, books, you know, it's, you know, we're not totally incapable of, you know, just completely combating that image. And actually, as a matter of fact, before I end, I do see this even a lot on social media now, even though it's in regards to politics and not necessarily like Afrofuturism and things like that. But, you know, you, of course, you have, you know, Black Twitter on Twitter itself, who, and they, you know, I would say we, because I'm included in that, even though Black Twitter isn't a you know, an official organized entity in any sort of way. But it's become kind of a thorn in the side of the establishment, because, you know, people who have historically not had a voice and not have been, you know, able to actually combat some of this propaganda that's been put out there, now actually have a voice and are now actually able to challenge narratives and challenge preconceived notions. You know, whether it's, you know, Oscar So White and the influence that had in changing things in Hollywood. You know, it's, things are changing. And I think that might be why people are reacting as viscerally to that change as they are in society today.
It's interesting too, because you mentioned the accessibility aspect of Farima. You know, I just find it interesting. I've had people say in the past, you know, there are people that will look at a book that is deemed a black novel or black fiction, and they'll say, well, how could I relate to that as a white person? And I'll always be like, you know, the human experience is pretty universal in a lot of ways. I'm not saying, I mean, there are different experiences based on if you're white or if you're a person of color, but, you know, I don't find it hard to relate to, you know, black movies or black fiction. And I've always found that very disturbing when people say, oh, I can't relate to this because I'm not a person of color.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just about exposure. I think people have to continue to be exposed to new things. You know, because, and I think we have to give people, you know, room to grow as well. Like, so, you know, the way I am right now today, it's not necessarily the way I was 10, 15 years ago. You know, people do have to evolve and change. And a lot of times that means coming in contact with things that, you know, you weren't necessarily raised on, or things that you might not have been exposed to earlier on in your life. I think the more we see, and then I don't mean to keep going back to Black Panther, but it's just so many ways I can weave that into the discussion right now. Like, even if you look at that movie, on paper, a movie like that really shouldn't have done as well as it did. You know, the mere fact that it did that well means that, of course, it had a lot of social media buzz and things like that as well. I don't know if there's ever been a Marvel movie that's had the type of buzz online that Black Panther did. But, and yes, that helped out a lot. But there were a lot of, you know, Black people, even white people who saw the movie and was like, hey, you know, that's not that bad. And it had a very, you know, almost all black cast set in an African country about an African king, you know, and there were so many things that, you know, somebody who might not have known better might have looked at that and said, hey, you know, that's going to bomb. You know, that's not going to be successful. But it was. And I think that says that if you actually create something that's good and that's interesting and that doesn't, you know, push people away, you know, and that doesn't say that, you know, oh, no, this is purely for us or this is purely ours or something like that. And you're just saying that, hey, you know, this is a new aesthetic that you might not have been familiar with before. But, you know, it's kind of cool. And we have, you know, these cool characters and, you create this story around it and you just make it fun. Then I think a lot of people would probably come around and you'd be like, you know what, that's interesting. You know, that might be a little bit better than I thought it was beforehand. And that's the impression that I think a lot of people have with that movie, with Black Panther. And I think potentially other authors as well. I don't really want to say any names, but there are a lot of other authors, a lot of other black authors who write in this genre as well. And their books have been very successful, you know. Their books have, they've won awards and their books have done great numbers and things like that. So I think, honestly, you know, not to sound be too long-winded, I think it's really just about exposure. And I think the more people are exposed to this genre and exposed to new things, the more they'll see that it's not, you know, it can be for them potentially.
Yeah, well, I always tell people, there's always something you can relate to in a character. You know, even if I'm reading as a dude, if I'm reading a female-centric novel, right? You know, I always say to people, it's not that hard to find a way to relate to the female character. We may have some differences, but ultimately, this female character is looking for love. I think men look for that too. You know, I think some people get caught up in these labels. I do think, you know, things like racism are an issue. So I'm not saying like everything is universally the same, but I think there is sort of a basic humanity we can find in characters, regardless of their gender or race. And I think that's how we can relate to them in fiction.
Right, right. There's this idea of the everyman. As a matter of fact, as I was writing Farama, I would watch these YouTube videos of this author by the name of Brandon Sanderson. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
No.
Yeah, you should probably check out some of his. He has like, I wouldn't say it's the whole course, but it was several videos on YouTube of him teaching this course, this creative writing course, and I was watching one of his videos and he was talking about the everyman. And so the everyman is pretty much just a character that everybody can, or at least most people can relate to, because they have a job or a profession, or they do something in the story that's relatable, you know, that people can you know, people are either they've done it themselves or they're familiar with what that is. And that kind of attaches you to that character and makes you a little bit more emotionally invested in that character. Now, every character doesn't have to be that way. Like, even if the character isn't an everyman, there might still be redeeming qualities in the character. Maybe the character might be going through something that you go through, or maybe the character has a certain tick or a certain hobby or a certain trait, whether it's positive or negative, that you can relate to. You know, so yeah, I would say, you know, people should probably start there as well. Like, outside of maybe just purely exposing themselves to it, you know, try when you're reading a story and it's not something that you would conventionally be into, try to look for something that you can identify with. And it might be something that you might be a little surprised by. So yeah, I think that's a good idea.
You know, it's interesting too. You mentioned the elements of blockchain in your story, and also the floating cities reminded me of, or the floating islands reminded me of Peter Thiel, who, you know, I consider Peter Thiel like the supervillain of all the billionaires these days, with his sort of whacked out libertarianism. But it's interesting because you're taking some of these ideas that get associated with, you know, the really weird end of libertarianism and applying them to the left. Was that deliberate on your part?
I mean, it kind of was. It's interesting with, like, so with blockchain, I'm actually writing something of a, I wouldn't call it a white paper per se, but I'm writing something that will, I'm going to be posting on social media probably within the next week. I think technology is going in a way where we can use something like blockchain to our advantage. And I think blockchain is, I don't really think it's political in nature, because it's really just it's a technology. Now, yeah, you do see a lot of people in the space who are on that side of the political spectrum. But when you're talking about, like, programming and just being able to program a token or program a currency of some sort, you can program it in any way that you want. Like, so you could, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be the way that other people have done, you know, their projects or their things. Like, I think you can make, you know, a left wing. They're like, within blockchain, there's this thing known as a DAC, a decentralized autonomous community. And it, you know, for all intents and purposes, is really just a community of people who are doing something where you know, the interface that they're interacting with is purely digital. Like, it's something that's known as, like, a smart contract. And you can code, because I do, like, a little bit of programming on the side as well. I've, like, learned JavaScript and things like that and C++. Like, you can code this stuff to reflect sort of your goals, and those goals might be left wing in nature. And, like, you could even, I think, create a token that could be used as a common resource pool. Like, I don't necessarily want to go too deep into that, because that's I haven't necessarily dropped the, you know, article yet. But yeah, like, that's honestly one of the reasons why I think that, you know, that's one of the things that I think people will be most surprised by when they read this, especially if you're in any way, shape, or form familiar with blockchain. I don't think people are going to be expecting to read this book and see something like that. And I didn't go too deep into it, because, you know, I didn't want it's not an economic book. Like, it's a science fiction book. So I didn't focus too much on the economy, but I just kind of put that in there to say that, hey, you know, this is kind of like a decentralized, not a centralized, because it's, you know, it's a little bit more left wing in nature, but, like, it's this decentralized economy where people actually have direct control over the economy themselves, and not necessarily central banks or the NASDAQ or the Dow, whatever the case may be. It's a little bit more hands on. So I think I'm going to explore that. And I think, really, truth be told, I think that space could use some left wing opinions. That's just my personal opinion based on a lot of the videos I've seen.
Now, in regards to the characters focused on. We mentioned Dr. Greenheart, Dr. Nadia Greenheart. What led you to make her sort of the central focus? Was there any specific reason that you wanted to focus on a female character? I was interested in asking you about that.
That's honestly something where I said, I think that was really on my spirit. Like, 'cause at the time, there was a lot of discussions going on around, you know, female characters, the female characters and stories. And I mean, that's still something that's going on today, as a matter of fact. So I said, you know what, I, again, wanting to go in a completely different direction with the book, not just in the style and the aesthetic, but the centralization of the character. So I said, you know, they're probably in terms of, I haven't read every science fiction book, but if I were to wager, I would say that, you know, there's probably a little bit more male-centric stories than female-centric stories. So I kind of wanted to explore that. And then on top of that as well, the character kind of is inspired by a friend of mine, as a matter of fact, who we actually met each other in college, and we were both, like, I was a biotechnology major, and she was a chemistry major, something like that. And, you know, we kind of kicked it off and turned it into something special. So the character is really kind of like a wink and a nod to her, to be honest with you. And that's why I made her a scientist as well, because when I started writing the book, we were both like really deep and heavy into science because we were studying it in college. Because I actually went back to college, because I was saying earlier that I got a theater degree. And then when I graduated, I was working at the post office for like a couple years. Then I ended up going back to college to pursue like a science degree, a STEM degree. And so that's kind of where we kind of, you know, met each other. So yeah, it kind of like combining that with sort of what I was hearing online and social media, I said, you know what, you know, as I'm writing this book, let me do something that would kind of challenge me, you know, as a male writer, you know, let me challenge myself to actually see, you know, where I can go with this and actually try to see if I can contribute to changing narratives.
Now, before we start wrapping up, I wanted to talk current events just a little bit with you, maybe in the last 10 minutes or so here. I was curious because Farima, it stands in sort of stark contrast with its positive vision to the sort of world we're finding ourselves in now with, you know, the pandemic, the police brutality. There's a lot of suppression of activists going on, oppression of activists. What do you make of the current climate? In some ways, I've heard people say this feels worse than it's ever been before. Other people have said, no, you know, the fact that we're, you know, starting to fight back means that things are going to get better. Where do you stand on current events?
And I'm so glad you asked me that. Man, like, I don't know if we have the time to really go into it. Really go into my feelings, and I'm laughing now to really try to suppress a lot of angst and frustration that I actually feel on the inside. Yeah, COVID has been an absolute disaster, and mostly in terms of how our government has responded to it.
It's interesting, not to interrupt you. I was going to say, I keep telling people, no one likes to bring up this point, and people get mad at me when I say it. It didn't need to be this way. It did not. This whole COVID thing did not need to end the way it has, or gone the way it has gone. I mean, this could have been handled much better, and a lot of people's lives could have been saved.
For sure, for sure. And I mean, yeah, we still would have had deaths, but it wouldn't have been nearly as you know, out of control as it is right now. In the beginning, we actually had the ability to contain it. You know, if different decisions had been made, if we had people in power who actually believed in science and weren't, you know, anti-science, and I don't even know if it's so much about them just being anti-science as much as they just don't care. Like, I really believe, like, there are legit sociopaths in power, you know, not even just at the national level. I'm even talking about like at the state level. Like if you look at decisions being made in Florida with Ron DeSantis, if you look at decisions being made in Georgia with Brian Kemp, who really even shouldn't be in office, but he is, you know, it makes absolutely no sense. And I think we're at a critical mass in this country right now where people have profiteered on propaganda for so long that I think you have a segment of society that really just doesn't know how to discern between what's right and what's wrong anymore. I think so many people are just caught up in sticking it to the left and antagonizing the left and just being anti, you know, SJW, which is a term that they like to use a lot, or just being anti anything that's like remotely progressive. It's broken brains, man. Like I really don't know how to describe it. Like there have been times where I kind of just sit back, because I used to have my own podcast show. I don't really post on it too much anymore because
the independent rebel, right?
Right. It was Spreaker, and it was a Spreaker show, and I did like a few of those. And I even before that, I used to have this blog called Black and Intellectual that's not up anymore. I actually started that in 2017. And I had like, I had a YouTube channel. The YouTube channel is actually still up, by the way. I never took it down. And I had like a bunch of videos on there. I used to do like live streams and things like that. I kind of stopped doing that because it really kind of just started messing with my mental health. Like I'm just being 100% honest right now. Cause like when you are constantly like bombarded like daily, like every day with negative stories, that does something to your spirit. Like it does something, it messes you up in some ways. And I mean, it really shouldn't be like that. And like going back to COVID, like I've had people in my family who have been exposed to it. You know, I had to go to a funeral, and they couldn't even put everybody in the funeral home and in the church because of social distancing orders. Like it was crazy.
I felt bad when I first contacted you because I think I contacted you around the time the funeral happened and you said, oh, I can't do it now because I didn't mean to catch you at a bad time, but it's been bad for a lot of
people.
You're
fine. Yeah. No, you're fine. It's not really something I talked about too much. So I made like one mention of it on Twitter because I don't really like talking too much personal stuff on social media like that. But yeah, it's really unfortunate. And then, I don't know if you heard about what's going on in Portland right now with these not unclothed, but unidentifiable, what looks like some type of paramilitary force just going around, just disappearing people. And I mean,
Chicago. You mean the thing with the unmarked vans? I've been seeing videos of people being taken away by unmarked vans. It's very odd.
Exactly. It's extremely odd, and I think people have kind of found the source of it. I think there's somehow connected to DHS, you know, Homeland Security. But you know, regardless of where their origins are, like that shouldn't be happening, you know. And then on top of like the George Floyd protests, which you know that was everywhere pretty much. And then as soon as it didn't, the protest didn't even last that long. And as soon as they started getting a little too large and everybody in the world was talking about it and things like that, it like the drop of a hat, Trump comes out and threatens to use military force. Like they're itching for an altercation. And I've talked to people about this myself. It's almost as if I feel like the society is being poked and prodded, like not with an actual stick. I'm if you could see me right now, I'm like pointing my finger in the air, but it's like the society is like being poked and prodded, you know, almost as if there are certain people within the establishment that want an altercation. Like that's kind of how I feel about the situation right now. And what's crazy is like things are so out of control. Like we're about to have mass evictions because a lot of people were laid off or furloughed because of COVID-19. So a lot of people are out of work, and, you know, Congress is in recess. They're not extending unemployment benefits. Like they just don't care about what happens. And I think they're just falling back on the fact that they have this police state, this paramilitary force that can crack skulls whenever they need to. and protect them whenever they need to, which is probably why they were created in the first place. So the whole idea of, oh, well, we need this because of terrorists overseas and because of 9/11. No, they needed it because they saw a future where capitalism would start to fail, where society might start breaking down, and they knew that they would need a force to defend their property and to defend what they own that they've invested, you know, tens of millions of dollars in. You know, so I don't know how this is going to be fixed. I really don't. Like, and what's crazy is, I know we're talking about current events right now, but when I started writing Pharma, there's something I have in the book that I don't really want to go into too much detail about, but it's in this, one of the chapters is called The Battle of Charlotte. And I don't know if you've gotten that far in the book, but it's kind of weird. Like, it's really kind of weird how I started writing that book in 2016, sometime like late 2016 sometime. And something that I wrote in that book, something that I actually started putting in the outline originally when I wrote the book, it's kind of weird how it's in a very dark way, in a very kind of grim way, we almost seem to be going down that path right now. And it's that has to be prevented. I know like 2020 is coming around the election. I supported Bernie Sanders, but there was a point in time when I said, you know what, there's no way in the world I'm voting for Joe Biden. Joe Biden is extremely problematic, yada, yada, yada. But I don't know, like Trump has to be taken out of office. I mean,
well, that also doesn't make you pro Biden necessarily. I mean, you're voting anti-Trump more than pro Biden.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, that's not even going to fix anything. it's going to fix something very temporarily, but long term, like it's, we're still going to be up, you know, I don't know if you want me to cuss, but up, you know, what's creek without a paddle. So, like, so it's unfortunate. And I think, I just think things are spiraling out of control and I don't really know what the future holds, but that's kind of why I'm writing this white paper that I'll definitely send you guys when I publish it, because I think we're in a phase now where we really seriously need to think about reorganizing ourselves and creating something that's parallel to this society in general. Like, we're like people of like mind kind of need to start coming together, and instead of like protesting is good. I'm not saying don't protest, you know, that has its place, but you know, we need to do something outside of that. Like, we need to kind of take it up a notch and use different technological standards in place right now to actually build something that we can all use to our advantage, to our collective advantage. So yeah, I think, cause I really don't know how long this, we haven't even talked about climate change. Like, that's something else that's coming around. Like, it was just 100 degrees in the Arctic. Like, and we have politicians that poo-poo the idea of a Green New Deal, even though the Green New Deal is popular. You know, Medicare for All is popular. You know, we don't have representation. We don't have a representative government. And if we don't have a representative government, we don't have representative democracy. So we can't call ourselves a democracy if we're not actually getting representation. You know, it's something else. I was actually saying on Twitter yesterday, I was like, this is like a cartel almost. It feels like an oligarchic, plutocratic cartel, like of just these money interests that pay off politicians to do their bidding, and they're doing it in both political parties. So we don't really even have an opposition party. Like, it's, the whole thing is just effed up. And I mean, I don't know. I'm ranting now. I'll stop.
No, I completely feel you on that. And I was, I just wanted to add two things. Since you mentioned, you know, the anti-science aspect of all this, I've pushed back on that a little bit. I think a lot, I mean, I live in an area, I mean, in, well, I live in Pennsylvania. So there are parts of Pennsylvania that are extremely pro-Trump, including the suburbs. It's not always just rural areas. And the people I've known that are really pro-Trump, it's not even about being anti-science a lot of times. They just don't want to be told what to do at all. You know, and to them, it's right. like wearing a mask is an inconvenience. And, you know, I think people misinterpret it sometimes. It's not that, you know, they have some issue with science. I mean, it may be on some level, but they also just don't care. They're like, you're not going to tell me what to do. I saw someone at the grocery a few days ago, some white suburban dude who was like, you're going to let me into the grocery without a mask. And he broke through the employees and went on his merry way in. And they really, they didn't know what to do. They didn't even know how to kick him out because they were just like, oh, just let it go. But he wouldn't wear a mask. He's like, I'm not going to be told what to do. And I think that's a big problem we're facing.
Yeah, I feel you. I can definitely get with that. And I mean, I would agree as well. I don't know how much, that's why I kind of like, when I said that, I kind of like went back on it a tad because I don't really don't know how much of it is anti-science versus, yeah, like you said, just people just not caring and not just wanting to do whatever they want to do. And I mean, the thing is people can do that. Like they do have the right to just disregard all health warnings and health officials and, you know, climate science. People can kind of just live in whatever world they want to live in. Right. And, you know, there's an entire network of an entire cottage industry, you know, worth millions of dollars of people who will, you know, tell them that, hey, you know, what you're doing is the right thing to do when really it's not. Like it's dangerous. Like you're putting yourself at risk and you're putting your family at risk. If you catch something, you take it home with you and you're putting people around you at risk. Like, so I don't know. Like, I don't know how the only way we fix that is by mandating it, you know, mandating masks, but that's not going to happen in a lot of places. And even where I live in North Carolina, we have a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, and, you know, he has to kind of, yeah, he has people wanting to protest because we had the whole anti-, the protests where you had the militia people going around protesting things being opened back up and things like that.
Were saying liberate North Carolina, liberate Wisconsin, liberate, yeah.
Right. That was going on in North Carolina as well. So you even have like these Democratic politicians that kind of have to placate both sides. Like they have to try to appear to, you know, want to do the right thing, which is what they should be doing. But then they also have to, you know, placate to these people who just don't care about. And what honestly, I've also heard people say this. It's mighty interesting how when COVID first came around, people were very, you know, in the camp of shutting everything down. And that's what happened at first. Back before we started getting data and information about who was being impacted the most and things like that, that's back when people were saying, oh, no, you know, if you're young, yeah, you don't have anything to worry about. It's just older people. And it's mighty interesting how when it started coming out that, you know, there were a lot of, you know, black people because, you know, black people are the ones who are being deemed essential workers, working a lot of low wage jobs. So they're the ones on the front lines. When the data started coming out about who was, you know, getting it the most, who was suffering from it the most, all of a sudden everybody's like, hey, you know, let's just open back up. It's not that big of a deal. You know, it's we'll be able to get through it. And I just find that interesting. Of course, we can't really say specifically what people's motivations are unless they come out and say it. But I don't know. You just look at American history. You just look at how these things usually play out, and it's not really hard to imagine, you know, people only feeling that way. People only wanting to open up, not wanting to wear a mask, because they don't think it's going to actually impact them. You know, they think it's going to impact another demographic. So that's just even more selfish, you know. So it's crazy. Like what I'm doing, I have plenty of masks. You know, I even wear gloves out sometimes. You know, I'm definitely taking care of myself, and because I don't want to catch this thing for sure. And I am fortunate enough to where I'm kind of privileged to be able to work from home, you know, so I don't have to actually go out somewhere to a brick and mortar place and work and be in the elements and things like that. So I do have that going for me as well. But I have to before I end, I have like teachers in my family. So I have people around me who are going to be in a month or so going to be like knee deep in, you know, a lot of ground zeros, you know, because a lot of people have said, you know, schools are like petri dishes for all sorts of, you know, sicknesses and things like that. So I'm definitely a little stressed out for sure.
Last thing I wanted to mention was Black Lives Matter and the Floyd protests, because I keep, you know, it's interesting. Every person I've talked to who believes that Black Lives Matter, that they're not saying what, you know, these crazy Trump supporters say of, why do we say Black Lives Matter? Why don't all lives matter? And I'm just like, well, yeah, everyone agrees that all lives matter. It's just that, you know, the police apparently have forgotten that Black lives matter, which is why incidents like the George Floyd incident keep happening. And I don't know. I'm just like really frustrated with some of the way that Black activists in this country get mischaracterized. I mean, you know, some of the loudest activists I've heard pointing out police brutality and police misconduct against not just people of color, but also poorer whites. It's always the Black Lives Matter people that do that. And I'm just amazed at the amount of propaganda that people will just swallow wholesale when it comes to BLM, this anti-BLM propaganda.
Yeah, I think people will believe anything if they don't actually believe in what you're saying. Like, so like I said earlier, like there's a whole propaganda network. They're not even just like Fox News, but online now there are YouTube channels and there's an entire network of people dedicated to saying that, no, the problem with society isn't what the government is doing to a particular group of people. The problem with society are the people themselves. It's always easy to blame the victim than it is to blame the power structure, because the power structure is paying a lot of people, you know, and people have kind of been raised to believe in these mythologies about America. And all countries have mythologies. Like, it's not just America, but you know, people, I don't know. It's frustrating because the evidence is clearly there, right? People have the videos, you know, and it's not even, I wouldn't even say even just going back the past 5 years, 6 years, whatever the case may be, going back to like the Mike Brown protest. That's kind of where the new generation kind of kicked off around the Zimmerman trial. But it really goes back decades. Like, you can find, find videos, not videos, but images, pictures from the 60s of like civil rights activists holding up signs saying like, down with the police state. Like Black people have literally been talking about the police state for generations now. Like, and even if you look at the origin of policing, like it's the origin is in slavery. Like, one of their early jobs originally was to catch runaway slaves, you know? And it's very interesting how people have kind of compartmentalized American history. And to be fair, to be as fair as possible, a lot of this stuff isn't readily known. Like, a lot of people, like, for instance, for the very first time recently, because of the Watchmen show, a TV show, the Watchmen was originally like a graphic novel, but they made like this really kind of bad movie of like a few, like 10 years ago. But like they recently remade it. Well, not remade the graphic novel, but they did like a sequel to it type of thing. And I want to say it was on like HBO, and the first episode took place in 1929, I want to say, in Tulsa. Like, so that, like, people, a lot of people didn't know that that actually happened. A lot of people don't know that, you know, you had this successful, you know, Black district in this city that was literally razed to the ground, uprooted and destroyed, even bombed from the air. Okay, there was somebody who took like some sort of little crop duster plane or something like that, and literally like dropped dynamite, sticks of dynamite, over like the Black area of the town. And A lot of people didn't know that. Why? Because it's not something that's taught. You know, it took a TV show, a fictional TV show about like a superhero, to expose people to American history. So I think a huge problem is a lot of people have just been misled, man. Like a lot of people have really just been misled, and it takes a lot to actually learn something like this, take it in, and realize that what you've been raised to believe, to an extent, not completely, but to an extent, is something of a lie. Like that this country that you have kind of, you know, grown your, you know, become like emotionally attached to, has done some bad things, some really bad things. And I'm not even just talking about recent wars and things like that. I'm talking about since 1776. And even prior, has done some very dark and diabolical things. And this is part of American history, you know. And I think if we, talking about what we were going back to what we were talking about earlier about envisioning a better future, a part of that is some type of reconciliation and saying that, hey, you know, this is what has been done and this is how we have to fix it. You know, it doesn't require all of this animus. I really don't understand that. But when you have people who are making a lot of money off of propaganda and spreading propaganda, and you have another group of people who aren't making money off of it, but they need that. They need that lie.
Well, they need a scapegoat.
Yeah, exactly. Like they need something to latch on to not have to change their worldview, and they'll believe anything. Like, so honestly, me personally, bro, if you're talking to somebody and you're not really getting anywhere, and it's like you're talking to a brick wall almost, I would just leave that person alone, just leave them be, and either they're either going to get it or they're not going to get it. Because at this point, with all of the evidence that's at our disposal online with the internet and social media, if people don't get it now, it's because they probably don't want to get it. You know, and they're protecting, you know, an aspect of their psychology or upbringing or whatever the case may be. So yeah, that's my opinion on it. Like it's one thing I will say is before Martin Luther King died, he was very unpopular. Like this is something that is kind of been swept under the rug because everybody now tries to look back and say, oh yeah, I was supportive of the civil rights movement, yada yada yada. No, y'all weren't. Like when he was murdered, when he was assassinated, he was very, very unpopular because he came out against the Vietnam War on top of all the other things he was talking about. And of course, he was a democratic socialist as well. So he wanted to reallocate, you know, wealth and things like that, and had some, you know, believed in reparations and all. So it's the struggle for freedom, whether it's, you know, in terms of Black people, whether it's in terms of women, whether it's in terms of people within the LGBT community, it's probably never going to be. Well, I would say this. Let me correct myself. I was about to say it's probably never going to be universally popular until it changes. But that's actually changing now. That's really not true, because recent polls have actually shown that the majority of the people in the country actually do support Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And that's made people like Tucker Carlson and other hosts on Fox News pretty upset, because that's historically that has not been the case, you know. So that is something that has that's changed, and I think that's something positive to look forward to.
I definitely think it's something positive to look forward to. I don't know. I always reference that, you know. I'm a big fan of Ice-T and his band Body Count, his metal band. He has that song, No Lives Matter, where he basically sums it up. He says, you know, at the end of the day, this police state, you know, in this case, Trump, right, the Trump junta, they don't care. No lives matter to these people as long as their pocketbooks are getting filled. And you see that more and more with, you know, the climate change crisis looming over us. And I just hope that one day, you know, people will be able to band together and realize who's trying to, you know, put us down.
Right. And I mean, what's interesting about that as well is when you look at Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, what's the other one? Blue Lives Matter.
Oh God, blue. Don't
somebody, get me started. Somebody said the only difference between these three, you know, terms or slogans, whatever you want to call them, the only difference is that first word. You know, it's the black. You know, that had to be removed because that's the biggest problem that people have. People have some sort of a problem with people, especially black people, like speaking up for themselves. Like, you know, black people have historically been expected to be subservient and expected to be docile and not resistant. Like, historically, there's been a lot of fear, actually, even going back to slavery, of some sort of black uprising and stuff like that, because of people being afraid about what happened in Haiti and you know, the Haitian Revolution and things like that. So that there's always been like this fear of you know, this black uprising historically. Also, like you can trace it, like even like out of slavery, you know, going to the 60s with COINTELPRO and you know, J. Edgar Hoover and the fear of a black messiah, which was actually something they wrote. There's a history to this, and what I think we see is that that history continues. That despite what a lot of us have been taught, this is like, I'm a millennial. Like, a lot of people have been raised in my generation, because we didn't grow up in that era, to believe that, oh no, the worst of racism is in the past. You know, all that stuff you heard about, that's just stuff in the history books. That's not something that goes on today. And no, what we've actually seen over the past, you know, 5-6 years now, is that no, like there's still a struggle that has to be fought. Like there's still changes that need to be made. Yes, we've made progress. We've made a good amount of progress, but there's still a lot that needs to be done. And when you have somebody like Trump in office who is quite literally trying to take us back 50 years with you know, Sessions, like they're actually gutting, you know, civil rights legislation, the Supreme Court. And I know this predates Trump, but the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in 2013. There is a faction within America, a very old faction, but a faction nonetheless, who I think is trying to take this country back and trying to destroy a lot of the gains that have been made. So it's definitely alarming. The only thing we really can do is fight back against it to the best of our ability. Everybody can't be a protester. Everybody doesn't have the physical capabilities of just going out and standing in the heat. And especially with everything going on right now, they're shooting rubber bullets at people's faces. That's not non-lethal. That can kill a person depending on where it hits. So if you can't do that, there are other things that you could potentially do. You know, there are economic things that you could do. You know, support people that are, you know, doing good things on the ground. I don't know. It's you know, there are mutual aid networks. Like there are co-ops that I want to see develop more. So. I don't know. Like, I don't really think that Black Lives Matter is going anywhere. But I do think that potentially, especially if we don't get Trump out of office, we could be going down a very dark road where I think you're going to see a lot of left wing, not just Black Lives Matter, but a lot of left wing movements become a lot more directly targeted. Like if we're already at the phase in Trump's first administration, or not his first administration, but his first term, if we're already at the phase where they're disappearing people and you have these quasi-military forces just grabbing people off the street and throwing them into black, you know, trucks or whatever, we're already there. So I can only imagine where we might be 2 years from now or even a year from now if he doesn't get out of office. And I think we could potentially see like a lot of civil rights abuses, like flagrant civil rights abuses in the future if something isn't done about this. Because I don't know, like it just feels like this society is deteriorating right now. So we'll see what happens for sure.
Well, Brian Lewis, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Let my listeners know real quick how they can get a hold of Farima.
Farima, you can find it on Amazon. Just, you know, go to Amazon.com, type in Farima. You can also probably go find it in the Google search engine as well, because there aren't too many things that go by that name. Then you can also find me on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook like that. I technically have a Facebook page that I don't use, that I don't really log into. But on Twitter, it's @_blackintellect. And yeah, like if you don't mind like my political views, if you don't mind the occasional, you know, critical view of the police state and state violence and voter suppression and things like that, then definitely follow me. And I'll follow back, and I also, you know, reply to people. I'm not one of these people who are kind of like, you know, too into myself, you know, and think that I'm above conversation with people. So yeah, definitely just reach out to me, and we can chop it up.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Brian Lewis, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brian M. Lewis, author of Farima, an Afrofuturist sci-fi adventure. Check it out, folks, if you can. I think you'll enjoy it. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email @ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. And of course, if you can, support me on Patreon. Shout out to my second tier, $10 tier Patreon supporters, including Amelia, Martin, Mark, Gary, and Brace. Join them in helping to keep this show alive. Patreon.com/ParallaxViews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.